And welcome, Dr. Smith. This is the session of the House and Senate HES committees. Present are Senator Paul Fisher, Joe Josephson, and Representatives Davis and Co-Chair Tischer of the House Committee. Senator Moss has entered the room. And Senator Vic Fisher will be with us shortly. Dr. Smith, the practice that we're following is to conduct hearings. As you know, the nominees for the governor's cabinet come before the joint session of the legislature, and it's a constitutional responsibility of ours to meet with the nominees and interrogate the nominees and make recommendations to the colleagues we have in the House and Senate. Do you have any preparatory remarks you'd like to make to the joint session of the HES committees relative to your background or plans for the department?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'd just like to say very briefly that I consider it quite an opportunity to come and serve at the governor's pleasure and to be able to offer my services to the people of Alaska. Philosophically, I think it appropriate to make a comment at this time regarding my expectations. Essentially, I think there are two that are very important, not necessarily in any particular priority, but I hope to be a cost-effective, trustworthy manager of the state's resources, the people's resources, that will be entrusted to my care in the Department of Health and Social Services. And secondly, I think it is very important that the required leadership be brought forth to lead the manpower resources that are also entrusted to my care. In that regard, let me say very briefly that I am a very strong believer that the attitude, particularly in the department that I hope to lead, is an extremely important item. And I hope that my talents and my experience and training can be brought to bear to permeate the system of delivery, that the attitude in the delivery of those services will be very creditable, not only
we are in an environment of fiscal dampening down, and the activities that you are responsible for are particularly sensitive. Do you consider that within the cabinet and your dealings with the governor that you can be an advocate for those programs, understanding that you may have to, as a team player, support the governor's ultimate conclusions, but within the counsel that he gets, can you be an advocate for the programs and for the clients of your department?
Without reservation or equivocation, the answer is yes, Mr. Chairman.
Are you planning any particular kinds of reorganization of the department from an administrative structural point of view? Can you tell us what that might be?
The answer, again, is yes, and I'll be happy to acquaint you with it. Below the commissioner, I look at two essential deputates, a deputy commissioner for health and a deputy commissioner for social services. All divisional deliveries, Mr. Chairman, from the department will go through those two deputates. Everything to the right, and Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to provide you what I hope will be I think you might be able to follow me a little more closely. It's such a copy. Let me repeat, Mr. Chairman, now that you have a copy before you, that to the left of center will be two deputates, one for health, the other for social services. All delivery services out of the department will go through or down from in line of those two deputates. As you look at the assistant commissioner for administration and staff support, over to the right, I view all other services as being just that, administration and staff support. There are two special assistants that are in position now, and we look forward towards having a third that is currently being recruited. I view the special assistant's responsibility for law as being extremely important. I am trying to address one of the important items covered in the task force report, and that is that 75% to 80% of the problems associated with contract review, grievance, and ultimate litigation might be short-circuited or, if you will, prevented in the area that I call legal propriety. The moment that we view ourselves gravitating toward a legal or, if you will, a serious grievance matter, I will have a competent individual to counsel and guide me. I'm hoping that we can reduce such matters in the future, and to reserve for the Attorney General that remaining 20 or 25% workload. I'm trying to short-circuit as much as possible the pipeline time that the task force referred to by the volume of work going out of HSS over to the Attorney General's office.
Well, I see Representative Tischer and other legislators have a question, but I see one thing I want to ask you about right off the top, and it is at the top of the chart. You show Governor Sheffield, the Chief of Staff, and the Commissioner. Does this imply that the Commissioner must go through the Chief of Staff before having access to the Governor?
On the contrary, the answer is no. On routine, the block to which you are referring is really a coordination block, has no line authority whatsoever. The governor has made that point very, very clear. And I've had no difficulty whatsoever in gaining access direct to the governor, and he expects that such matters will be dealt with him on a personal basis.
Representative Tischer and then Senator Moss. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Smith, in your curriculum vitae, you have noted here that under employment, that you were law school advisor in 1974 to 83. And then I'm looking up in your educational area. Can you tell me, did you go to law school? And if so, what, where is it shown here?
I mean to imply, Madam Co-Chairman, that as a law school advisor, first of all, let me say, as you all know, we do not have a law school in our state. The job at the university called for one who had a limited competency to be able to advise students on a routine basis who would be aspiring for law school. Let me answer your question very pointedly. I am not a practitioner of law. I have not attended a law school. I have studied international law in my curriculum towards the doctorate, but that was, shall we say, an advisory responsibility to students in preparing them in preparation, applying, and so forth for law school.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To you, I would like to ask a question here that disturbs me. I feel that perhaps Dr. Smith is well qualified for the job that he's been selected for. But I have a little difficulty in figuring out why it is you got to have Peter McDowell down here signing off on your group of people that you're going to select here. Peter McDowell, I might point out, was one of the guys that created his own office space by a study that he made for a 30-day period of time. We got back two pages of paper, $5,000 a piece. He ended up with a so-called director, OMB here, Peter McDowell. Why does he have to sign off on your stuff? This bugs me because right here I see you being restricted right off the bat. You're one of the few that I've seen so far that I got any sympathy for.
Let me try to answer your question, sir. I think essentially...
For the record, I think the senator, because this would be a transcript of this, was referring to a document with your chart, organizational chart, and then I think the legend was approved by Peter McDowell of OMB. Go ahead, Mr. Commissioner.
Essentially, what Mr. McDowell's signature connotes is that the manpower authorization and fiscally are consistent with his record. His signature is not an approval authority type authentication. There is only one approval authority there that indeed makes the document official, and that is the governor's.
I worry because you guys that's going to be good commissioners are going to be hamstrung by these cotton fingers down here that's trying to do everything. Like I say, Mr. Chairman, I'm real pleased with Dr. Smith here. I think we've got a good man here.
Yes, sir.
But then I don't want to end up here with him having to ask this guy McDowell to do something in health, education, and social services.
I'm sympathetic with that, Senator, because I think the other day, Commissioner, when you were here, we had a discussion, and I forget what the topic was, but I recall, I understood you to say, in answer to a question, that's something that I can't answer because it has to be answered at a policy level. And for my part, subject to the overall coordination by the governor, you are the policy person for the Department of Health and Social Services. I can't stress personally that I hope you will remain the policy person and not be simply carrying out policy instructions from those, Senator Moss says, who may not know the programs nearly as well as you.
Yeah.
And
Senator, I'm trying to tell you what to do.
Senator Fisher, were you?
Yes, I just want to follow up this comment, Mr. Chairman, by pointing out that this is a very important point because we have an issue before us now, before the legislature, the elimination of a certificate of need, which the administration has decided almost a priori that they favor that we abolish the certificate of need, whereas the department has some serious concerns because it affects Medicaid and lots of other aspects of the department's responsibilities. And as Senator Moss points out, and the chairman, it's critical to us that we know what the professionals in the department have to say, even though we respect the governor's role as the leader of the state administration. We still have to know what the professionals think on the given issue. And I'm real glad this point was raised. Mr. Chairman, while I'm talking, may I?
Yes, I'd like to note the presence of President Curtula.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I have had the privilege in years past of being a professional colleague of Commissioner Smith's, and so I know him quite well and have a lot of respect for his abilities. My initial point was going to be very much the same as where Senator Josephson started, and that is the issue of advocacy for the clientele of a department. Now, so far as I'm concerned, government really should have limited functions. I think Alaska's state government is partly because we've become so wealthy as sort of oozed out all over. But among the very basic functions recognized in the Constitution, recognized traditionally in your political science professor, is taking care of sort of the basic functions of government and the domestic front, education and various others, and taking care of the needs of the needy, those that cannot be helped unless society steps in. And to me, this is very important that our government assume responsibility for the health, for the needs of those who simply are not being taken care of by the federal government, who have problems, the disabled, the children, the poor, the poorest of the poor, and so on. And as the chairman, I think it's just very important that you be able to carry the banner. And again, that relates to what Senator Moss was saying, sort of regardless of the administration's overall position. It's just critical that we have an independent voice on these matters. And I just want to throw the ball to you, and if you want to comment, I'd appreciate it. Otherwise,
let me say very briefly, Senator, that I feel you have the right person.
Well, I look forward to your doing that job. May I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of items. One is the whole budget situation. I know this happened before you had much to do with it, but corrections, in a way, is moving out of your department with, in effect, a big chunk of money and positions that have been transferred from a lot of the other divisions to corrections over the past 2 years as the problems within corrections got more serious, positions being limited, they were simply transferred to corrections from other areas. Do you see any hope for rectifying that balance, I mean, sort of to make up for the problems that have been caused by that, especially in view of the budget stringencies that we face now?
Senator, the answer to the question is definitely
yes. However, I hasten to emphasize that management can involve technical means of innovation, creativity through merging, and techniques of cost effectiveness only so far. And we have in the Department of Health and Social Services have reached what I call the critical point of fiscal flexibility. We have been able to invoke some management principles to lessen the effects of those fiscal transfers to which you have referred. However, if you were to ask me tomorrow whether or not I could effectively undergo a 5% or 10% additional reduction, I'm saying to you today that we have an extremely limited capability without further means of measurement, evaluation, far greater than I have to my disposal at this time.
Commissioner, on this matter of budget, President Curtula would like to inquire regarding Senate Bill 158. And I think it's very pertinent at this time.
You've been the commissioner and the administrator, the chief executive officer of that particular department. You're now seeking to be confirmed to for, what, several weeks, haven't you?
At least about 6 weeks or a better.
I've always appreciated the courtesies which you've extended to me at the University of Alaska personally, and I won't forget them.
Thank you, sir.
I did appreciate it,
Thank you, sir.
I continue to. I have a question, and did you participate in Senate Bill 158? It came in today, so I haven't had a chance to get a hold of you until now. That was the bill by the governor, rules by request of the governor that makes reappropriations and appropriation adjustments. I'll bring it up to you because it's important that I do so. I want to know, you have been commissioner for as long as the administration has existed effectively. And this is a reappropriation, appropriation adjustment, and it appropriates to many sources, including the University of Alaska, for a potential land settlement. And it takes from other areas that lapses are predicted in. And there are problems with the poor people in this state. Some people say, give my capital budget to the poor people. But of course, we have some problems here. Did you agree to this particular transfer of $5 million from aid to dependent children back to the general fund for purposes of this bill? Were you part of it? Or the general relief from reductions?
Not initially.
Are you satisfied? Do you have the information? Or were you part of the decision making, or was it just dumped upon you to do so? And I suppose I'm here in an embarrassing situation, but that is not my intention, because I frankly, undoubtedly, will be supporting your confirmation, you know, for other reasons. But I'm curious about the system that leads us to this $5 million cut in those areas.
Let me address the senator's question in this context. I did make a personal appraisal of some reductions that took place prior to coming on board, some of which I am sure I would have made had I been on board. There were others that I probably would have scrutinized more closely and possibly made different recommendations to the governor.
Well,
you don't wish to follow it up.
Thank you,
you,
Senator.
You do have the bill in your committee.
We just got this bill, and it's the first time I've seen it. The president pointed out to me this morning, but under public assistance, it appears that maybe it's unfair to do this with you at the other end of the table, but that there would be a transfer reducing from $55,600,000 to $49,357,000. Now, are you saying that was decided before, you know, only these possibilities, before Governor Sheffield took office, or after Governor Sheffield took office and before you were sworn in, or after you were sworn in with your involvement? I don't know what it
or
is.
Without.
Or without your involvement, or over your objection.
I would say that both the 5% level of reduction in the department, as well as some 13 at one time, 10 at another, spaces allocated to corrections, plus some 41 spaces associated with the proposed transfer of corrections, that is, the establishment of a department of corrections, that this occurred before I arrived on board.
Commissioner, these seem to be reallocations or appropriation adjustments for this fiscal year.
Reduction, significant.
Not the 5% that we know we're going to have, or that the governor proposes we have in FY84. And going on, we see AFDC becomes $35,570,000 instead of $41,690,400, which the previous legislature provided.
Mm-hmm.
Continue. General relief becomes $700,000 instead of $900,000. I can't at this moment comment except to tell you where some of us have our values, and I think as Senator Petula and Senator Fisher indicated, the true test of a civilized government is how it takes care of the least people least able to take care of themselves. And I put it to you that from that vantage point, we appear to be going in the wrong direction. And I wonder, what did the Commissioner of Health and, you know, when did the Commissioner of Health and Social Services know about this, and what did the Commissioner of Health and Social Services do about it in terms of the advice you gave the administration?
As you mentioned, sir, earlier regarding the advocacy, I'm trying to, as candidly as I can, advise the Senator, the Chairman, what actually occurred. There were, to the tune of approximately $2.8 million in management administrative space transfers that were made before I came on board. In addition, there were subsequent, possibly to what you're referring to now, additional reductions made at which I did get involved. What I am trying to make clear here today is that the 5% reduction, the space reductions that were made to help corrections, they were made before I came on board.
I wished one question.
Yes, sir. Please. For two of them.
I suppose it goes right down to this. Since every year since I've been here, there have been supplementals for these purposes. Almost every one of the 20 years. Much hotly debated. And since there's so much unemployment and so many other problems with the working poor, I'm surprised, and I'm sure you must have statistical evidence to back this cut, but I'm surprised that this cut has occurred, and I just want to know if your department had endorsed it and had supported it and had recommended it to the bookkeepers, or if, let's face it, an aggressive bookkeeper did exactly what he did in the farming area without enough brains to ask the questions, came in and made the decision for you.
I think it's fair to say that I have carefully examined our fiscal picture today, and I do not anticipate that I would have to meet the future as a result of supplementals. In fact, we are under a policy provision to add and delete at this time.
What you're telling me then is you're satisfied with statistical evidence to support you that you can reduce the budget by that amount in these categories and not hurt any truly deserving, necessary participant.
That is essentially correct, sir.
Senator Ross.
I hope you're right.
Dr. Smith, are you seem a little hesitant when you talk about these things, as if perhaps you might have been intimidated into accepting this from a higher level? Maybe from this fellow McDowell?
Not at all, sir.
Well, the point I'm getting at is, let's just ask a straight question.
Okay.
What did you have anything to do with cutting this 5% out? Did you have anything to do with picking up on this dead burn bill that we've got here that cuts $5 million out of a project that apparently we needed? Have you got $5 million in your budget right now that is excess on the 83 budget?
As I said before, sir, the 5% level reduction was made, Senator Boyle, before I came on board.
Well, excuse me, Senator,
I still want to dig into this.
All right.
I do too. I'm just a little bit sore here because I see the administration digging again into what we made into law last year. At least this time they're bringing it out in the bill form where we can kick it out. But at least they're getting honest about it now, Mr. Chairman, the way I see it.
Well, assuming for the sake of argument that you made a professional judgment that there was excessive money in the relief program and AFDC and the other program, did you consider or recommend the transfer of those monies into other activities of the department which we know have shortfalls, such as in the catastrophic medical program, in lieu of transferring the monies into the general fund?
The answer to that question, I did not have that opportunity.
Because you were told that that wasn't the way it was going to be.
That is essentially correct.
Representative Capone, and then Mr. Tischer, and then Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, statistics can sometimes be deceiving when they don't want to compare apples and oranges.
Can't hear you there.
I believe that statistics can be confusing when we compare apples and oranges. I realize that, for example, General Lake Medical has a surplus, even though there should have been an increase in applications due to the discontinuance of a good share of the Native Health Service program and others. However, going back some years, if I remember correctly, the regulations that were drawn up, not in statute form, attempted to deal with the problem that we had a federal program that dealt with part of the population and a state program which dealt with the rest of the population, and that we were unable, we could not legally or morally draw distinctions on a racial basis. Federal government was doing. But the regulations, as I remember them, provide the General Relief Medical is otherwise identical to the old Native Health Service program, except that the
Joint Legislative Reform Committee meeting on March 10th, 1983, 12 noon, actually 12:15, is called to order. Presence, members present, Representative Miller, Walker, Senators Kelly, Gray, Chairman Representative, a co-chairman Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, co-chairman Fakes is Senate business.
And okay, for the record, Senator Fakes is in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the Senate leadership for the White House briefing. At this time, I'll pass Jan Bonhoff to give the report for the NCSL for the record. For the record, Jen.
My name is Jan Bonhoff. I'm speaking on behalf of Senator Fakes, who asked me to give this report, which she enjoyed. Also, in your packet, included in the paperclip was a memo from Bill Barrier that pertained to Bill that arrived just about 5 minutes to 12, because that's quite substantial. NCSL, as you know, was here last week. Two people, Bill Pound and Jan Carpenter, and they conducted a number of interviews. The list of the people that they managed to see.
All these things are not.
The people that they managed to see last week is included in your packet. I was the one that set up the appointments for those people, and I tried, first of all, to get all the members of the committee. I tried to get leadership positions. with Cindy Simon yesterday, who is the project coordinator for NCSL. She said that Bill and Jan, along with the other people from NCSL who will be assigned to this project, underwent an extensive briefing after they returned. Two particular people have been assigned to the ethics question. They are well aware of our need for haste in this matter and are reviewing all the material that we've sent them on ethics and incorporating with that the information that Jan and Bill gleaned last week. One of the things that they are discussing and have suggested to us is that when they have gone through this material and done the research, that we set up a teleconference between those staffers that have the information and members of this committee. I cited as that along for the committee's perusal, there have been a number of different approaches suggested. This is the most recent one. And you want to discuss that.
Any questions from the committee?
Yes, I have first. Yes, the teleconference would be after we have written notification of the questions.
No, I think they're thinking in terms of a teleconference as a work session kind of thing to discuss a bit of what suggestions they have come up with. See how the committee reacts to that and then proceed from there, maybe doing further research and checking out other things after the committee asks questions. That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
I would see that a more fruitful teleconference would only come up after we had in writing their suggestions so that we could research them ourselves and we'd come up with our questions.
Further questions? Okay, thanks. At this time, I'll just give a brief report and you can send it to Ray. If you want, and that's on the Attorney General's progress dealing with conflict of interest legislation. About 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago, we, the co-chairmen, chairman of the committee, Senator Jake Stein, made a request to the AG's office to come up with a draft of legislation dealing with conflict of interest. And I got a commitment from them yesterday that they would try to have the draft ready for this committee's review a week from this Monday. That's the extent of my report as far as the conflict of interest legislation is concerned. Senator, in your packet, you also have not only the uniform rules dealing with the title change, but Rule 23, plus a list of all the people who have been interviewed thus far by the NCSL group, and a draft form of the code of ethics for the committee to review, criticize, critique it, or reject. That's about it. I have comments to observe. Well, there's one more thing I want to add. Billy Barrier will have uniform rules, potential problems with some of the rules before this committee by a week from today. So that will be presented to the committee members for their review and then we'll just go from there. Do we have any other questions or comments from the members of the committee?
One question. How are we doing on the timeline? I know that we're really
to, because that request came from Senator Fakes.
Those have been the ones that seem to be the most troublesome.
Senator Kelly?
Somebody actually suggested I'm a change the rule. You can't change an amendment in one in the other house.
It's just being listed. We wanted a clarification. There was some thinking that the bill title could be changed with the two-thirds voted in the House of Origin, but that is not what the rule says. And so it's just to clarify what we can and cannot do with the rule. There's no move to change that now.
That answers the question. Yeah, I have nothing to add to the committee. If any members have anything to say or comment.
About this work draft, he wants to go over this and make suggestions to you then.
Yes, it's just for your review. You've gotten about 3 or 4 different drafts of legislation dealing with code of ethics from various members of the legislature, and this is just one more. Look at. Senator Rand.
I wasn't listening. Did I understand somebody say that you couldn't change the title in the House of Origin?
It takes a concurrent resolution.
The House of Origin?
Yes.
Well, I don't believe that.
See, the other house. She was talking about it. Could you do it in the other house on 2/3 vote? But Bill Gary's as well. It takes a concurrent resolution. Did you read that one?
That's fine. But in the House of Origin, you could change the title. Of the
yes. That's correct.
Concurrence of the majority.
That's correct, yes.
That's fine. Representative Locker?
I would just like to leave the committee with a couple of thoughts. There have been several special committees that have been formed in this legislature. And the one that we are now sitting on has the shortest life. And I wonder if that's because we do not feel that we need reform or if we need it in a hurry.
Senator Reddy, I know you had to comment as well.
I think, without being too punitive, I think it was the short-sightedness of the House in which you served that caused the time constraints. And I don't know who the proposers of the amendment were, but I think that they weren't too wise, and I don't think that the amendment was timely. I can't remember who it was.
I don't either, but we should find out.
We'll always search for you, sir.
Senator, we'll do the best we can with the reality of the situation right now. If there's nothing else to bring before the committee, unless there's members of the public here that would like to raise any questions. Okay.
They've been left in between. There have been bills introduced in the past to establish a pool, an insurance pool within the state to take care of those people. Is this something that is on your agenda? It's supposedly it wouldn't cost the state any money because by pooling those people's insurance payment would take care of their needs. Have you gotten into this? Is this on your agenda at all?
It's definitely on my agenda, and as of last week, we took some action to improve the situation with the governor's approval. I'll be happy to provide you the details of action that we've taken very recently. One of the big problems, I dread coming back to that, but we are captured by eligibility factors that are tied to federal programs. And this is one of the items now that John Katz is on the scene in Washington. And we brought this up with both senators during their recent visit. Ultimately, I can foresee on the horizon that to gain relief and to be able to exercise some of the prerogatives that we would like to do within the state, we will have to seek federal relief before we will be able to effectively.
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand what the feds have to do with this at all. I'm talking of a state established pool. income people now, the lower middle income, were not covered. I said aside from the AFDC and other types, aside from general relief, aside from the upper income or government employees who are covered by insurance, there's a gap in there.
You're thinking principally of GRC?
I'm not talking of anything. There is no state program for these people now, none whatsoever. But there are people, let's say the independent businessman, he does not have an insurance program. He could pay phenomenally high individual Red Cross rates. The casual laborer who is not a member of a union, and he's not poor, he's not qualified for Medicaid, is not old, not under Medicare, not a government employee, not working for ARCO and their insurance. There are thousands, probably tens of thousands of Alaskans who today carry no medical insurance because there's no affordable insurance for them. And proposals have been made in the past to establish a pool, just like the car insurance pool for, you know, if you're familiar with that, which doesn't cost the state any money, but the state facilitates it. That's what I was talking about.
I understand.
If you're not into that, I'd like to hear about it.
I just put on.
What are the duties of the assistant commissioner in South Central, and why is that region in your organizational chart to be treated with an assistant commissioner on a regional basis?
Largely because, Senator, one of the largest concentration of responses by sheer population number occurs in that area. To have the kind of interface with the municipality of Anchorage, its programs, and clients and our people operating in that area. To answer your specific question, why have one there? We need facilitation of the tremendous volume of services that are being rendered there. Secondly, we need someone who can troubleshoot in the name of the commissioner without having to refer to Juno. We have numerous problems that arise there, and we need someone who can spend the time and respond to problems in that area. The magnitude is so great of our operations there.
Dr. Smith, one of maybe it's a parochial concern of mine is that for the past several years through, I think, House Bill 50, Senate Bill 168, the state government has made money available for capital and social service projects which local governments can utilize for social service purposes. And I know in my own experience the Anchorage Assembly in its judgment has annually allocated $2 to $3 million which was made available to nonprofit organizations providing essential social services, human services. The proposed governor's budget that we see does not have any item for that. The programs that are being funded in Anchorage will come to a halt unless that's rectified. Have you considered what the appropriate role of the state is and whether there should be an item on that and how we could continue to fund those social service
Very definitely, Senator, and we've met on two separate occasions with officials and representatives from the municipality of Anchorage. There is a third meeting that will take place on the scene in Anchorage.
When?
Before the end of this month. And the reason for the delay is a matter of planning both on their end as well as here. The state support for social services pertinent to Anchorage in the past has been largely through the route of grants. There has not been, on the contrary, there has not been a substantial contribution from Anchorage through the revenue source to any social services. And in their briefing that was recently given to the governor's staff, I noted under the role of the advocacy that you mentioned earlier, that was conspicuously absent. They subsequently went back to their assembly and to the mayor. And as a result, there will be approximately $3 million or more appropriated from that source for the first time.
From what source? You mean from a local source?
From local source revenues.
Who told you that would happen? The administration of Mayor Knowles or?
Administration of Mayor Knowles.
Where are they going to get?
I'm hoping that they will have a contribution this time.
Well,
according to his administration, we've been assured of that.
Excuse me, how much money is involved?
Approximately $2.5 to $3 million.
Was
the figure?
Money?
No.
And how much state?
Local money.
How much state?
About the same amount by way of grants. There has been traditional funds allocated to Anchorage through the grant route for social purposes.
So you're saying that this program, which if we're speaking of the same program, the programs that have been allocated through a citizen advisory task force on an annual basis and then confirmed by the assembly, which I think at the maximum was $3 million, will now be a $6 million program with some local money and some state money? Is that what you're asking?
This is what we are looking forward to.
Senator Moss?
Thank you, Chairman. Dr. Smith, it seems kind of funny to me. I still like to know where they're going to get that money. Is that going to be some money the state's contributing to some of their projects? And they just end up with it there and they're going to give it to you? Are they going to add maybe $1 million or $0.5 million tax deal down there? That's one question I got. And I'd like to ask one more question. What is the salary of the assistant commissioner in the South Central region which you are now placing into the position there? And what's the difference between an assistant commissioner and a deputy commissioner's pay scale?
The deputy commissioner would be a grade 28, and we are looking at the assistant commissioner's grade of grade 27, pretty sure.
27?
27. R27.
Your assistant commissioner is on board now. Is that a 27?
27. Assistant 27, sir. The deputy, to answer your question specifically, the deputy commissioners are R28s. And the assistant commissioners are 27.
Okay, one more question. How much money are we talking about? I don't know what that scale is.
I think we're looking at approximately $4,800 or more, close to that figure, monthly.
$5,000, that's pretty close to $60,000 by the time you still verify all the benefits and stuff the state's got put in there. At $60,000, we're looking at $2.5 million more. Which I'll bet you a dollar bill is going to come out of the state's hip pockets through some other deal. It's just like this bill we got here we're looking at. I don't see where none of that money is being taken out of there, where it's going. Maybe it's going into something like this. I don't know.
Senator Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, I've been working with several of the senators on rectifying the problem of general relief and eliminating the $80 ceiling on payment. We've been trying to get a figure out of your department for about 4 or 5 weeks as to how much money would be involved in doing what it is that we have in mind. I'm told that the figure, the response is somewhere in the commissioner's office now and then has to go to OMB. At the rate this has been going, the session will be over, and the poor of Alaska are going to be without health for one more year. Do you know anything about that?
That is the one that I was referring to earlier, in which the governor approved, and they are in the process of implementing now. It is not at OMB.
Excuse me, I don't know what we're talking about. The governor, what are we implementing?
I think the particular program that you just referred to.
This The general relief program now has a statutory ceiling of $80 payments.
That is correct.
The governor cannot waive the statutory ceiling of payments, can he?
No.
Okay. I have a bill drafted that would eliminate that ceiling. Senator Ferguson and some others and I are working on that. It would. It's a bill that would eliminate the ceiling. We're trying to get an estimate of cost from your department. I don't see how the governor would be implementing that.
No, I have not seen that particular matter.
Well,
you're
I'm referring. Told it's somewhere in the commissioner's office, and I would appreciate
I'd be
that
happy
being
to make a note of that.
I'm sort of concerned about all these things that are not happening, that are not coming to the surface. Another thing in general relief, the income limits are established by regulation. Maybe you're talking about that. I'm not sure, but the income limits have been totally unrealistic in view of today's world, and possibly the department is finally getting around to dealing with that. I'm not sure. That's what's being implemented.
Are there further questions to?
Only to suggest that there's also a memo from Family and Youth Services that's stuck in your office, and we want to get the hell out of Juneau, and I'm not sure whether it's because it's a new administration, but it's getting extremely frustrating not being able to get responses out of your department as well as others. But since you're here, I'm addressing you. We need to get our job done. 6 weeks or whatever the session has gone already, or seven, and we're just being held up, and we've got to get action out of your office.
Let me say this, Senator, feel confident and assured that anything that is in my office that is pending action, all you have to do is call the commissioner
all
with
right.
specificity. We're more than happy to
all
serve.
Right. You'll hear from us quite
yeah.
a bit from
yes.
now on.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
And we will have you back, and I think the pendency of Senate Bill 158 suggests that we may, as a HES committee, want to review some budget items with you. Some of us will see those again in the Finance Committee, but I think we want to do that and appreciate your time. Are there other questions to be posed to Dr. Smith at this time?
Just a comment. I really like to commend you on your the way you handled things. I think you were very honest with us, and to that I commend you. And I guess I would echo what Senator Miller said. I think following his advice, I think we'll all be very, very happy with you as well.
Thank you very much.
And I do want to echo something else that Senator Petula said. Some of the greatest public servants, although it's not really an American tradition, but some of the greatest public servants are the people who walk out over principle if they feel that their mission is too badly impaired, so that the public knows where the responsibility lies. And I hope that never comes to pass in this administration. But if it does, I hope I can depend on you to do just that, so that we know where the buck stops and where the accountability lies.
You can feel sure, sir,
of
that part.
Thank you, Doctor. And now we have Mrs. Ann Parrish, who is a nominee for regent to the University Board of Regents. I'd like to welcome you, Ann.
Thank you.
Your resume is in our folders, and if you have any statement you'd like to make concerning your nomination.
Well, first off, I would like to thank you for a private hearing. I was out of the state for 3 weeks, beginning the end of January, and your letter for the original regent review was received at my home while I was gone and opened when I came back 2 weeks ago. So I appreciate the opportunity to come to Juneau and meet with you today.
Do you have anything you'd like to tell us about your interest in the university or parts of your background that you believe are particularly pertinent? I understand you have a degree from the university.
That's correct. I originally attended Brigham Young University in Utah as an English major when I was first out of high school. And I came to Alaska in 1969 and went back to school in Fairbanks. My private employment had redirected my career path into accounting and finance, and I attended the university in Fairbanks. Also, when my spouse and I moved to Anchorage, I re-enrolled at UAA and attended there as a full-time and also as a part-time student after I passed the CPA exam and went to work full-time, and did receive a degree from there in 1978. I have a stepdaughter who is presently a junior at the University of Alaska. I am director of recruiting for my firm, and in that capacity, I recruit for the firm on a national basis at various universities. And I guess so I have been a purchaser of services of the university, both as a student and now also as in private industry. Within my career path, I am a certified public accountant. I do management consulting to both nonprofit and private entities. And I have a bit of an emphasis in data processing. And I believe that, those skills, dimension and background, bring a dimension to the Regents in addressing the future of the university in the state of Alaska.
Are there questions to Ms. Parrish?
One general one, and I have one other, and that is the English, original English major indicates a great arts, liberal arts, broad background. You must have a little more to add to the following question. What is your philosophy of education? And that's difficult to ask. It's even a question difficult to ask correctly. But, and as it pertains to higher education, what do you think the mission of this land-grant institution should be? I realize that you're new at this particular thing, Anne, but you're an Alaskan, and you have
that's
a good
right.
education.
That's right.
And I worry about just putting out technicians.
I worry about that very much. And I believe education and learning has to have some practical application. And I, in the limited amount of time that I've had in the last 2 weeks to digest the information that's been submitted to me from the university, I think that I have become somewhat aware of the diverse role that the university has because of the degree, three universities, the ACC and the community college role, and the Cree role, where the needs more address the specific area that they are operating in. More specifically, I guess I feel that the university should provide quality, constant education that a student in whatever program they're enrolled in can depend upon for quality. And if the university can't offer that quality on a consistent basis, that perhaps this is not the place to do it. And I think there are certain areas where obviously Alaska excels and can really be leaders in education. Other areas where perhaps there are institutions outside of the state that can address those needs far more effectively and efficiently than we can at this point in time with our existing funding and population base. I don't know if I answered your question.
I read into it what I want.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell me what you read into it? I can tell you if that's how I feel.
which leads me to the one statement that I'd like to make, because every region I've had an opportunity with making. Vic Fisher, as you know, was a framer of the state constitution, one of the framers of it. And during that period, there was a tremendous political onslaught on universities. They were to teach in a fashion that was suggested by McCarthy, Hamill in the state of Washington, and many others. And I went to school in that period too, so I associate myself with a constitutional framework that says this, as a farmer would interpret it. And that is that you are part, when you become a Board of Regents, of a separate branch of government, Section 26. You're a separate entity. No governor nor legislature should in any way tell you, tell the regions. And this is difficult because we're all political appointees at some stage, right? Either going directly to people or going to the governor or some of her appointments. But nobody should tell the Board of Regents what should be taught in that institution, nor what library books should be in that institution. You're separately framed in our state constitution. And it concerns me always that every region put on that mantle and not succumb to pressures from Jay Curtula, not succumb to pressures from governors or anyone else without full well recognizing their responsibilities to the public. Reasonably, you have to come to us for your budget, so there is input. But nonetheless, you have to separate, you have to keep separate in our constitution the university, as the judiciary does. They don't invite input from a governor or a legislator either into their decision-making, only at the budget level and for administrative purposes, but not for a rendition of their services. And I think every region has to closely look at that very valuable constitutional document.
I agree. And I support the theory of the university as a separate fourth branch and the regents as a policy-setting body. I would like to believe that as a regent, however, because I would be closer to the detail information and to the, whatever you want to call it, the spirit, the feeling of that university and the needs and our own capacity to meet them, that in a policy role, I should be able to advise you of what needs to be done, but get the exchange from the people that talk to you about that, and I would expect the same kind of a relationship with the executive branch. Obviously, the development of a plan for the university has to be coordinated with a long-range plan for the state in view of the funding impact that the state has on the university. And I guess if I have any one mission in my mind, it's to make certain that I know what we're doing and hopefully why we're doing it, so that when we have a resource allocation problem, we can discuss it honestly and open and resolve it within the framework of what funds are available to the state and make the best decisions for the people and the students.
Well, the final thing, and it leads to this, is a very tough statement, and one sometimes that I lose friends with. But 3 years ago or 4 years ago, when a number of regents were appointed at the same time, Tom Nikolaus is one of them, I wrote them a letter, Herb Lang's another, and I said that this appointment is not a reward for services rendered, no matter how much you may think, that you should not sit on your laurels, but you better go to work, because this institution needs a lot of help. And take 70 or 80 days a year of effort. And I think John Shively reacted the best to it. He understood what I'm saying. As a long-time Alaskan resident, I feel that way. And that's what it's going to take out of you.
Well, I'm very aware of that, and I can tell you that at the point in time that I made the commitment that I would accept the appointment as a regent, that I did some serious thinking both with myself, with my firm, and with the people in my personal life, because I am the kind of person that I'm fairly concentrated, and I rarely get involved in things that I don't have a tendency to do more than I probably should, but it's a level that I need so that I know what I'm talking about. I don't wing it perhaps as well as some people. And from a commitment standpoint, I can assure you that if I cannot give the time to the job that it needs to have, I will notify the government, the governor, so that he can make a satisfactory reappointment. I'm committed to giving it my time and my effort, and that's a bit of a trick right now after being gone for 3 months in January.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things that the president has touched on is important to me. I think he and I came out of the same era. And that is ERA. And that is the question of the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake the ability of a university to search out truth wherever that leads, and the ability of scholars to do their work regardless of the unpopularity or unconventional aspects of it, and regardless of whether politicians or regents or chambers of commerce or Sierra clubs or whatever happen to like it or dislike it. And I think in a state like ours, where there really is not a significant private sector,
that the public university has to be extremely sensitive to that. And I need to know, as one of 60 legislators, and I need to have the kind of relationship with you that assures me that as a public regent, you will be a defender of the right of scholars at the university, regardless of whether, and we had this happen in the Senate Finance Committee yesterday by one of my colleagues who thought that a particular scholar, and I criticize him myself, but a particular scholar was a bigot because of something he wrote. I think it is a job of the regent to defend academic inquiry, whether it's popular or not, or offends one group or not, and I need to know how you feel about that.
I feel that that's a vital role in education. I guess I'm not sure that it should be 50% of the role, and I'm not familiar enough with the actual resource allocation, Senator, to say that it's one way or the other. But I believe that research and the furthering of knowledge, so that we stay technically aware, and that that occurs within the public. The public education system is important. I guess until today, I've probably not really addressed that issue. I've looked at the percentage for research in the budget. I'm aware of the problem with tenured research right now, and I understand that it's an issue. But I'm not aware enough of the actual stats and dollars.
There are many legislators, much more influential than I think, who share that concern. And I'm not addressing that in terms of the overall proportion of the university's program that should be involved in research. What I'm addressing is picking and choosing among researchers or wanting immediate returns from a particular project, or allowing some scholar to be on a hit list because he happens to oppose this gas line or something of that sort. That's the kind of thing I want to avoid.
I guess it's far enough from my thought process that I understand it. I'm violated by it. However, I'm not surprised.
And if I may follow up on this, I spent 10 years as director of the Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research, and headquartered in Fairbanks at the time. And we dealt with all sorts of policy issues. Such as oil taxation. We had individuals on the staff who, as individuals, went out, and some were activists against the war in Vietnam at a time when it wasn't particularly fashionable to be so. There were other cases. There were regents who came to the president of the university and said the Chamber of Commerce is up in arms, or legislators who came to the regents or to the president and said, you've got to fire so-and-so, he's against oil, or you've got to fire so-and-so, he's not a patriot, or you've got to, it was truly issues of academic freedom. Mm-hmm. There were other cases when there were people in the Department of English who were freewheeling poets, and they offended some people. And so individuals, politicians went after their scalps. I think that's what we're talking about here. It's important that the freedom of expression, the academic freedom, not be infringed upon for political or emotional or wrong reasons. And this case that was discussed yesterday is one that I had to live with for many years and suffer for because of that. And it's a real problem for the university. But it's a matter of academic freedom that is so basic to any and every university that if that's infringed, the university is going to be just rendered impotent, and I think that's what
I agree, and I believe I'm finally on the same wavelength and with what you were saying. I guess initially I was addressing the allocation between research and teaching, and my response there is that I agree with academic freedom on the campus. At the same time, I believe that the mandate of the university, in addition to that, is to provide quality education accessible by the people and the youth of Alaska or whomever, and I'm concerned with that as well. I think they both make for a better university.
You will be in a position to see that as an academician or as a person on the regents to be involved in that. We should not be, and you should not succumb to our demands when they get into the academic freedom realm, as I say.
Okay.
There's not really a dichotomy here, because I think some of us feel that that the student will learn best and grow fastest in a free atmosphere, a community of scholars, rather than in a constrained atmosphere. Senator Fisher?
Sure. And you said in response to the very first question as to your philosophy of education, I think I wrote it down correctly, that education and learning has to have some practical application. How would you feel about philosophy and English lit and various other pursuits that really in our world may not have direct application but make well-rounded members of society?
I believe that's practical.
The old liberal arts education concept.
In my mind, I think education should be usable, should apply, should even if it's on an individual basis. Maybe the word practical was wrong. I just believe that education for the sake of education, without reaching or some goal in mind, has a tendency to not produce the same quality.
If I may just make one final comment. I think you've heard here that you should not be influenced by unduly influenced by legislators. I would like to emphasize unduly.
We'll give you a list of those you can influence.
Will it be coded with you for unduly?
We'll give you the duly list and the unduly list.
Some of us, and Senator Curtula among them, have a very deep interest in the University of Alaska, and we're concerned with it. We want it to be as good a university as we possibly can have in the state. And we often do have ideas. We communicate with a lot of people. And so if someday I call you up, it would be during the interim, and suggest we go at lunch together and talk about some of my ideas. I hope you won't hang up on me at that time.
I have not been known to hang up on people. I have been known as being difficult to get, and I'm also not a frequent luncher. But I would be happy to talk to you. And I guess probably I should let you know that my theory and the way that I try to address things is that really basically decisions are easy to make. It's getting all of the facts that's the tough part, and usually when you have all the facts, the decision is obvious. And so from the standpoint of wanting more input, more information from people like Senator Curtula, other individuals at the university, I went to the open house at the pub a week ago Wednesday, even though I'd only been back in town for 2 days, and was scared to death that someone would ask me something I didn't know, because I believe that the community advisory councils, the students of the university, the faculty, the legislators are all valuable sources of information that I am going to need, and certainly in the first year or two, to get a full, well-rounded statewide perspective of my role as a regent. And I would hope that I'll be a relatively quiet regent in the first year until I know what I'm talking about.
Do you have a kind of an image of the University of Alaska or the community colleges a vision you would like to leave as your legacy after you have served as a regent?
No. No. I guess that I would just like to feel that I made things a little bit better. Hopefully a lot better, but I could, someone defined progress for me the other day as slow movement in the right direction. And I'd like to believe that it's faster, but the longer I'm around, I'm not sure it is. So.
Are there other questions, Mr. Parrish?
Just one, Mr. Parrish. Why do you feel that out of possibly 100,000 people out there that possibly meet the criteria of age, et cetera, that the governor selected you?
I've heard that that's a question that's frequently asked, and so I've got to tell you, I thought about it for a little while. I think he selected me for a number of reasons, and I would probably like to rank them in the priority that I believe they stand in. I think the first one is that I have worked for him and with him in a number of capacities using the skill that I have in the financial area, and I have performed well. I think the second one is that I knew him on a personal basis long before, well, I don't know that it was long before he thought about running for governor the first time, when I was also enrolled as a student at the university. And I'm sure that he remembers some of my comments about the university and the services that I received there and what I wanted to get there. And I believe that he knows that I had a commitment to education for myself and hopes, because he believes in education for the state, that I will have it in the role as a regent.
Senator Ross?
I just wanted to ask a question on that line now. Have you seen a difference in candidate Sheffield and Governor Sheffield now in your philosophy?
Never ask someone close to an individual to evaluate them. I lost my objectivity years ago. I don't think Bill Sheffield will ever change in my mind, but I'm glad that he's governor.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry that I was at another meeting, but I was curious if you talked about what you envision to be the main campus, or what you envision to be the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Do you have any comments on the Fairbanks campus? Perhaps you've already addressed that.
No, I haven't. I understand that the regent policy right now is to provide housing at Juneau and at Anchorage, and I believe that I concur with that. As far as the role of the Fairbanks campus, I believe we have a facility there that has equity in the facility that certainly needs maintenance, but is not subject, and even when you review the statistical data, to the same kind of growth requirements or equity commitments in the budgeting process that the other areas of the state are. And I'm not saying that I don't know if you want it to think of it in terms as a mother campus. I believe it will be the mother campus purely in size and by location of the statewide function. I don't know if I answered your question.
You answered any numbers.
Philosophically, I believe that one of the things that we need to look at, and I think it gets back to where do we put universities and how do we respond to the legislative impact. And I know that some universities have been placed, not universities, but basically community colleges are placed in remote areas that may or may not prove efficient over time. And from the standpoint of looking at those three locations, and the little bit that I know about Juneau, I guess I'm basically pleased by the plan there to offer a good core basic education and specialize in areas that logically belong to this geographical area. And I would probably support a similar approach for Anchorage because we do not have the quality of the quantity of enrollment that other states have the opportunity to build from, that perhaps we should do what we can do the best in one place.
Well, what do you mean? You mean that there are, you think there are too many programs offered in Anchorage now? Or?
Did I say that?
I don't know.
I don't know. I question whether or not we can be all things to all people in all places. given the limited enrollment at those facilities, and offer a program that someone can get through in a logical scenario over time. And I'm not familiar enough right now with the articulation or, you know, the actual structuring of the courses to address that. But I know that from reading the financial statements, apparently there has been some shifting and movement and elimination of duplication in programs. And I would say that right now, philosophically, I concur with that, to make the programs where they are the best and offer in each location a good, solid core undergraduate program.
You wouldn't be for duplication of major programs on the Fairbanks campus. They're now there in Anchorage, if in fact there's sufficient space and ability for the Fairbanks campus to continue in that program. For instance, some particular course in engineering. It already exists in Fairbanks. You don't see a reason for duplication of that, say, the last 2 years of that course in Anchorage.
Unless the enrollment and the facilities, the investment is there, can be made there for enrollment that can carry itself. Yes, I would say that's what I would probably say.
I understand. I mean, you received your...